Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, immigration attorney J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda, has seen firsthand the hostility, exploitation, and indifference immigrants experience. In his new book, No Human is Illegal, he writes about visiting border detention centers, defending undocumented immigrants in court, and offering legal services to JFK Airport to represent people turned away at the gates during the Trump administration's travel ban. He also writes about how children are treated. J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda is an immigration lawyer working at the Immigration Law Clinic at UC Davis School of Law. He's a former Immigration Justice Corps fellow and a Fulbright scholar, and J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda joins us in studio. Hi, J.J., welcome to the show, and I know that you drove a lengthy, about 3 hours to get here, so I really appreciate the effort you took to come on the show today. Thank you.
No, thanks for having me, Rose. Really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you. This is a very personal story for you. It's your story. It's your family's story. You write that you became an immigration lawyer because of your mom's experiences. She fled Chile after the coup that installed Augusto Pinochet. And you write about her first-person account of the coup and its aftermath. Tell us a little bit about your mom's experience and how that inspired you to become an immigration rights attorney.
Well, I think immigration is... in the U.S. is really personal for a lot of people, and I wanted to share that with people who may think, you know, I'm different or it's not something that should be talked about. But yeah, my mother was a supporter of Salvador Allende in the 70s, who was the socialist president, democratically elected there. And when he was ousted on September 11th, ironically, 1973, her and her family members and other people that she knew really well were being tortured and disappeared. And so she fled to the U.S. She didn't know at the time that the U.S. had such an influence in bringing Pinochet to power. So it's ironic that she ended up here. But it was she ended up working at a Mexican restaurant for a dollar a day. And then she ended up getting her Ph.D. eventually. So she lived the American dream, as she always says, and it's the greatest country in the world. And to see what the U.S. has been doing to its immigrants recently, it's really inspired me to take on this work.
As your mom learned about the U.S. role in Chile, how did that shape her views about U.S. foreign policy and why so many people leave Central America, let's say, to come to the United States?
Well, what she always told me was that people don't leave home unless there's a reason, right? People have a home, and unless you're pushed out of there, unless you're forced out of there, you're not going to leave. And that's what happened to her, and that's why she became an activist as well for immigrants, because she knew that a lot of people face the same challenges, not just in leaving home, but in finding a new home.
What do you think it will take to include more information about U.S. foreign policy and the connections between past policies and current policies and why people leave? Luckily we have an hour on this show, so we're able to really go in depth. We had historian Dana Frank on the show, who has a book called The Long Honduran Night, and it's about U.S. foreign policy in Honduras. We did an entire show about Harvest of Empire that looks at each country in Central America and U.S. foreign policy there, and then they interview people about why they've left. But in the soundbite culture that we live in, and you know, the cable shows with all the talking heads, it's really hard to get context and this history. And it's just really important when you're talking about why so many people choose to leave.
Absolutely. I mean, the all the points you make are absolutely right, and there is. The U.S. is completely responsible for a lot of the people, especially in the Northern Triangle countries. We've seen people coming from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, and the U.S. intervention in those countries, in Guatemala in 54, in Honduras and El Salvador in the 80s. I mean, these things sort of echo through time, and they definitely have made it so those countries aren't safe and aren't prosperous. And the U.S. has reaped a lot of those benefits from those countries, and now they're trying to shut the door. In the 90s, for example, there was a class action called ABC. It was Church of ABC, I think it was called. And that was basically because the U.S. was denying asylum seekers asylum. People that were applying from asylum from Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, the U.S. was saying, no, we're not going to accept your asylum applications, because to do so would admit that things are really that bad in Central America. And the Reagan administration was saying, no, they aren't that bad. You know, this was the late 80s, sorry, not the 90s. But they were saying things aren't that bad in Central America. So if we accept your asylum applications, we're contradicting what we're saying. And so there was this whole class action, and they ended up accepting a lot of these asylum applications because they were denying 99.9% of them.
Wow. We recently spoke to a young woman from El Salvador who was involved with a gang member, and the gang threatened her life. And so she felt that she had no choice but to flee. She is now living with a family in the East Bay. And I asked her, what about your own government? What protections can you get from your own government? And she said none, because they work so closely with the police. And so in addition to U.S. foreign policy, I mean, we're talking about corrupt governments that are not providing safety to their own people. Can you also talk about that aspect of it?
Well, one of the grounds for asylum is you've been persecuted on account of five race, religion, nationality, and particular social group. And but it has to be usually someone that has the power to act and to govern. And in a lot of these Central American countries, the people that are applying for asylum because of gang violence, the argument is that the gangs basically act as the government actor, right? And so they are in charge, and they are the ones persecuting people, and the government is not able to stop them at all. So those are a lot of the asylum claims we're seeing from Central America, similar to the young woman you spoke with, that there's just no way to seek safety. It's not like in the U.S. where, you know, well, even in the U.S., I wouldn't say the police are perfect here, but we would assume that when you make a call and someone's threatening your life, there would be some protection for that. In these countries, there's not.
You also write about the trips that you took to Chile to really understand it better. What did you learn when you took those trips? What stood out for you?
A lot of things. I think seeing my mother's story and being able to re-engage with that story, I think was really important, because I'd seen my mother as a Chilean in the U.S., but I hadn't seen her as a Chilean in Chile. And learning about that history and that culture, and, you know, not just the military coup, and because that's sort of the more recent history, but a lot of the Mapuche, the indigenous people in southern Chile, which were this incredibly strong indigenous group that the Spanish were never able to conquer, and just incredible things about Chile. And it taught me a lot about the strength of my culture and my roots, and really helped me complete myself in my mind, at least.
Your mom became a U.S. citizen and even tried running for office. She was campaigning for Nevada State Senate in 1994. And you write that when you were young, you were subjected to some of the anti-immigrant hostility that she had to endure. You once overheard a voicemail someone left for her with death threats. And she learned to avoid approaching homes with cars that had NRA bumper stickers after getting a gun pulled on her. Can you tell us more about that? The effect it had on her and your family?
Well, it was interesting, because when I was kind of going through those memories and talking about it with my mom and cataloging it, it seemed like a long time ago, but then it also seemed very similar to what's going on in the current political landscape. And it sort of, that was why I included a lot of that story, because it just had such a immediacy to it as well. And it seems like there is no debate about policy. There is no debate about, back in that time, whether my mom would be a good candidate for the state senate. It was just that she was an immigrant, she was an outsider, she had an accent, and people weren't going to vote for her, and people were upset that she was even running for office and some of the views she was sharing. And I think that's really similar to a lot of the things we've seen now. I mean, it's great that we have this very diverse Congress, but I think there's a lot of people in echo chambers as well, and people very violently expressing their opinions.
Well, and as you write, on one occasion, a man shoved your mom and told her to, quote, get the hell off my property and out of my country. And, I mean, sometimes it's overwhelming to go on Twitter, because the videos that people are recording of everyday scenarios about this happening. I mean, my brother said it just happened to him a couple of months ago, and he's Native American. I mean, it's just, he says that, I mean, a lot of people that, you know, you talk to say that they feel just a little more, I don't know, like people are looking at them more, they hear this kind of language more, and now that we have cell phones, we're able to record it. So can you talk a little bit about that and just how that's really exposing this and really forcing people to have a conversation about this?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a real conversation going on. It seems like, I mean, my area is in immigration, and it seems like we haven't changed immigration law since 1996. And I'm sorry to hear about what happened to your brother, but all the people I've worked with are, you know, quote unquote illegals. And if they have a DUI or whatever, they're going to jail and they're going into the immigration pipeline and they're being deported. And there's just no real conversation about policy or about who people really are or what they've suffered. There's a serious lack of empathy, maybe, is I guess the word I'm looking for. And that's probably what your brother experienced as well, although I'm not an expert on those things.
Well, do you think that, though, that that's because the people that have the most racist things to say get the microphone, because it feels like there is a conversation happening, that there's more information out there, there's books being written. I mean, it's definitely happening in public media, it definitely happens on this show. Why do you think that the conversation's not happening?
Well, you're right. You shouldn't say the conversation's not happening. It seems like there's people talking past each other. There's a conversation like you and I are having of like-minded individuals, and on the other side, people like that threaten my mother are having their own conversation as well. And it doesn't seem like there's any intersection or a sharing of where people are coming from, because I don't think people really want to right now. People are really holding on to their convictions, and unfortunately that means a lot of racism and nativism at this point.
You do write about the experience you had when you offered legal services to JFK to represent people turned away at the gates during the Trump administration's infamous travel ban. I mean, this is one of the more hopeful parts of your book, because you write about the real solidarity that you experienced during that time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of the book, and one of the memories that I really hold on to, because I think, you know, it was a week into the Trump presidency and we had no idea what to expect, and we'd heard the campaign speeches and we thought it might have just been bluster, but a week into it and he signed these three executive orders, one of which was the Muslim travel ban, as we ended up calling it, and it was immediately clear that everything, our worst fears were completely confirmed. And so to see the turnout at JFK, and I think at airports across the country, I can't speak to that, but at JFK there was like thousands of protesters outside in the cold, and all of us attorneys were inside just, you know, trying to do anything we could. People were making signs. Some of these powerful corporate attorneys were buying immigration lawyers coffee just to participate, you know. Hmm. It was just this incredible solidarity that was such an awakening. And even as things have gotten worse and worse, it's sort of a memory I hold on to.
What is the status of that particular travel ban?
It's actually, I write about this in the book, but the day I got, that we returned from Spain, was the day that the Supreme Court said it could go into effect. And that was, I think, the third version. So the first version got enjoined in the courts, and then they changed it a bit, and then a second version got enjoined again. And then this third version, the Supreme Court let go into effect, supposedly because it wasn't focused completely on Muslims. I think Venezuela and North Korea and a couple other countries were included in there that made it seem like it wasn't straight up Muslim ban.
And since you brought up Spain, you traveled to Spain as a Fulbright scholar to study unaccompanied minors crossing the Mediterranean. You write about visiting immigration facilities in, is it Melilla?
Melilla,
Spanish,
yeah.
Melilla, a Spanish city on the northern coast of Africa. I mean, it was really amazing to learn about the differences between how immigrant children are treated in the U.S. and how they're treated in Spain. Can you tell us about those differences and what really stood out to you?
Well, a couple things. First off, under Spanish law, you're not allowed to detain immigrant children if they're under 18. So their facilities there are like halfway houses, right? So they can come in and out and go as they please, and they have food and they have comfortable beds, and they're not locked facilities in any way, which is good and bad. It's bad in that these kids are under 18 and they'll go out on the streets and have zero supervision for long hours of the day, so there's issues that can come up with that. But then also under Spanish law, not just kids, but adults too, when they're detained in immigrant detention, Spanish law holds that you can't, those detention centers cannot have the character of a jail. And so they really try and make them places they can come in and out of and not be jail-like like they are here in the U.S.
What parallels do you see between xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiments in the U.S. and in Spain?
Well, after we left Spain, there was in Andalusia, which is southern Spain, which is where most of the migrants crossing the Mediterranean arrive, there's been this rise of a really extreme right-wing party that Spain hasn't seen in a lot of years since Franco came out of power, passed away, sorry, and that they've really sort of gained a foothold in that area because that's where a lot of the immigrants are arriving, and they really have this strong anti-immigrant rhetoric, and it hasn't gotten to the national stage yet, but it's similar to sort of the Tea Party that eventually rolled into the Trump administration.
Today we are speaking with J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda about his new book, No Human is Illegal, An Attorney on the Front Lines of the Immigration War. J.J. is an immigration lawyer working at the Immigration Law Clinic at the University of California, Davis School of Law. He's a former Immigrant Justice Corps Fellow and Fulbright Scholar. And he writes about being on the front lines, about visiting border detention centers, defending undocumented immigrants in court, offering legal services at JFK to represent people when they were turned away at the gates. And so many people showed up to protest. If you have any questions for JJ about what he's experienced, immigration law, also, he writes about his personal story. If you or family members are immigrants and recently came to this country or came in the past and had to deal with some of these issues, we'd love to hear from you. We're also going to talk about what real reform would actually look like. The Republicans have done another amazing job of really putting the wall at the forefront, and that's the conversation. But what about immigration reform? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. JJ, we have done so many shows about young people who've been detained, and it is still shocking to say that some kids might not be reunited with their families. I mean, it's just still shocking to say that. In your book, you write about Alvaro, a 17-year-old immigrant boy who was detained for many months. Like so many of these youth, he attempted suicide. You write, quote, "The immigrants currently held in detention centers and jails across the U.S. are criminalized for their very existence, and thus for Alvaro and others, their only liberty lies in no longer existing." Okay, this is one area that definitely does not get much attention, just about how young people, and I'm sure adults, are committing suicide because the experiences are just so harrowing. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I actually...
Attempting, yeah.
So Alvaro, like everyone in the book, is sort of a composition of several clients just to protect attorney-client privilege and not share stories that aren't mine to share, really. But there are, I've spoken with several youth who have expressed suicidal ideations to me because, you know, unlike the criminal justice system or criminal injustice system, you when you're in immigration detention, there's no way to do your time. You don't know how long you'll be in there. And so it can just drag on and drag on. And these are kids that have suffered extreme trauma, either in their home countries, on the way here, or both. And the U.S. is treating their PTSD and their severe trauma with steel cages, which only augments the trauma. Last week I did congressional testimony with a psychiatrist, and she was talking a lot about the childhood trauma and the how we're basically creating a lost generation of a lot of these youth. And if we're talking about immigration reform, we have to talk about bettering these countries so that people want to stay in their country. And so if these immigrant youth are being traumatized here in the U.S. and really having to go back to their countries as angry at the U.S. or severely traumatized, that's not a way to rebuild or help these countries in any way.
You're right. I had visited Alvaro less than a week ago on a Thursday morning. It was the first time, the third time that I met him at the Detention Center. On the first visit, I remember that he was energetic and charismatic, and he convinced me that the half dozen slices on his forearm were only to get the guards' attention. The guards at the center soon after gave him a bloody ear from repeatedly slamming him to the concrete floor, or that's what he told me over the phone at least. The blood was dried and crusted on his right earlobe when I visited him the second time. By the third time, his energy was tapering off, but his spirit continued to rankle the guards. The guards began to cut his already limited privileges and jump at any excuse to punish him, especially with violence. How common is this?
You really picked the darkest part of the book to talk about.
I know. I know, but it's important because we hear about these kids who are being detained, but to learn about what they're actually facing, I mean, it needs to get out.
Absolutely. And, you know, I earlier this month, I went with a team of lawyers to visit the Homestead facility in Florida, which is an unlicensed facility where they're detaining, I think, 1,700 unaccompanied minors there. And there's a rule at the facility that no one can touch anyone. And so these kids that, you know, are just begging for some sort of warmth, if one of their friends get released, they can't hug them. They can't handshake, they can't high five, they can't do anything at all. And so when you're talking about the case in the book about Alvaro slicing his wrist, that was going on at Homestead as well, because people just want to feel something, and they're so in such pain that they make that pain physical as well.
What changes would you like to see? I was just reading yesterday that I believe it's the American Pediatric Association is asking to have oversight at these detention centers.
Yeah, I think there needs to be more mental health at the forefront, because these kids are truly suffering. The Homestead facility, again, for example, I think there's like 20 kids for every one clinician. They don't have any privacy. People aren't getting to talk about the trauma that they've suffered in their home country and that they're feeling now again here. And so I think if we're talking about any kind of changes, we need to talk about basic humanity and human dignity and start from there. And if the pediatrics want to help, if they're psychiatrists or psychologists, I mean, I think people do really want to help, but there's just no access and there's no will from the administration to do that.
Do you have any updates on Alvaro? Do you know where he is today, how he's doing?
Well, like I said, Alvaro's a composition of like two or three different clients. But the two people that he was based on have both been released. And it's amazing how well they are doing and how much of their trauma and difficulties was due completely to being detained.
Today we are joined by J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda. He is author of No Human is Illegal, an attorney on the front lines of the immigration war. J.J. is an immigration lawyer working at the Immigration Law Clinic at UC Davis. He's a former Immigration Justice Corps Fellow and Fulbright Scholar, and he writes about his experiences on the front lines of immigration. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with policy analyst Jihad Abu Salim and Ahmad Abu Artima, one of the organizers of the Gaza Great March of Return. That was the mass protest that called for the right of return for Palestinian refugees and an end to the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip by Israel. That is tomorrow. Later in the week, we will also get an update on the teachers' strike in Oakland. We will find out what is in the new contract. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda, author of No Human is Illegal, an attorney on the front lines of the immigration war, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Any final thoughts on what is happening with children, JJ? I mean, things are changing on a regular basis. Again, it's just shocking to think that some kids will not be reconnected with their families.
Yeah, well, I write about this in the book, too, that I think there's two really huge issues. One is obviously the traumatic, awful separation of families, the forced one that the Trump administration has done. And the other is this sort of long-term tragedy that is unaccompanied minors, people coming to the U.S. as, you know, 16, 17, 15-year-olds, people that are crossing this incredibly dangerous journey to come to the U.S. And some of those people come with brothers or sisters because they don't have any parents, and then they're separated from them as well. So there's this separation of non-traditional families happening as well. But to your point, yeah, the separation of families, we really don't know. The congressional hearing I was at last week, one of the attorneys who was on the panel with me said that, yes, the administration continues separating parents from children, and that parents from children are still separated and likely won't ever be reunited. So we've created this entire class of orphans that at some point they're just unaccompanied minors by the choice of the U.S. Foreign policy and the administration.
And here's a piece from the Washington Post on March 2nd. 29 parents from across Central America who were separated from their children by U.S. immigration agents last year crossed the border demanding asylum hearings that might allow them to reunite with their children. The group of parents quietly traveled north over the past month, assisted by a team of immigration lawyers who hatched a high-stakes plan to reunify families divided by the administration's separation policy. The 29 parents were among those deported without their children, who remain in the U.S. in shelters and foster homes or with relatives. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, what rights do these people have to come back and say, I want my daughter, I want my son?
Well, first off, I think that was a great article, but some sort of dangerous use of language as well, in that these people were trying to come back to the U.S. and being assisted by immigration attorneys. From everything I've heard from people working along the border and in Tijuana, the U.S. government has really had it after the immigration lawyers, and they're prosecuting people that are just leaving out water for migrants along the border. And, you know, there's colleagues that have their security clearance revoked by the Mexican government, so they can't go back to Tijuana to work in those things. And so it's sort of dangerous the way the Washington Post reported that the immigration lawyers, quote, hatched a plan and are doing the subversive thing. I think that's not doing anyone any favors, especially because it was very brave of the work they've done. But it depends on each individual case what rights they have. If they were deported, if they signed a voluntary departure that wasn't valid, it really depends on the situation of why they left the country and how they left the country. But as far as I know, from the class action litigation, they do have some rights to be reunited with their kids because they have come back to the U.S.
This piece reports that according to the Department of Health and Human Services, more than 2,700 children were separated from families along the border. 430 of the parents were deported without their children, and 200 of those parents remain separated today. It's interesting to hear you talk about the language that the Washington Post uses just in the first two paragraphs of this story. And you know, for someone who doesn't have the insider information that you have, you might not even stop and think about what that means, hatched a high-stakes plan. Can you talk about what else these lawyers are facing and what has really changed between the Obama administration and the Trump administration?
Well, I think we saw early on with former Attorney General Jeff Sessions when he was talking about, you know, these I can't remember what he called the immigration lawyers, but he called them, you know, shady immigration lawyers that are taking advantage of loopholes and all these things. And it sort of paints us in a light as we're doing something wrong, or we're helping people evade the system, you know, like the, you know, like we're Trump's tax lawyers or something like that, you know, we're just scheming the system. And that's not the case at all. But I think that's sort of carried on. And there's definitely been attacks on immigration lawyers and the work that we're doing, from cutting Legal Service Corporation funding to, like I mentioned, the people that work for this wonderful organization called Al Otro Lado in Tijuana and San Diego, and they're really being targeted by the government for their work trying to help asylum seekers at least just apply for asylum, you know? I mean, they're not even allowing people to apply for asylum. It's not about finding loopholes anymore. It's just getting the basic right under international law to apply for asylum.
And JJ, at this point, what do you think is most effective for people who want to speak out or, you know, to try to help these children? I mean, to think that they are without their families in these jails for months at a time. You know, luckily, some journalists are getting the story out about how they're being treated, whether they're abused, whether they're trying to commit suicide. But what can individuals do about this?
Well, I think that's one of the most heartening things I've seen so far in this job, especially since the election, is that people are really have sort of been woken from their stupor about what is really happening, and people are contributing in simple and really powerful ways, things that I couldn't do as an immigration lawyer. For example, one of the kids I worked with survived basically in detention by doing art. He was drawing every day. He was trying to work on a graphic novel about his story. And when he was released, there was some individuals in South Bay in Southern California that were able to donate, you know, $300 or $400 worth of art supplies for this kid. And so he's been able to draw incessantly since he's been out, and he's working on his graphic novel telling his story about being detained for over a year in these, you know, high security facilities. So things like that, things like, because the government, when someone's under 18 and they're released from detention, they have to be released to a sponsor, and often the sponsors are across the country, and the government would just buy a plane ticket, and it can cost, you know, $1,500, and then the sponsor's on the hook for that money. So we've had individuals step up and pay for those flights, all sorts of things that people have just done, and it's really been heartening to see.
I hate to go from a heartening story to a dark story, but I was just reminded of the children who were being drugged at the shelter, and I just found a Reveal piece from October 2018, and at that time, the U.S. government was violating a federal judge's order to stop medicating immigrant children held at a Texas shelter without proper consent, and to move the children to other housing. Do you have any updates on this aspect of the story?
Yeah, and strangely, I'm actually part of the team of lawyers that is doing that class action litigation. It's through the Flores mm-hmm. Settlement Agreement. And basically, it was an order that Judge Dolly G issued in the Central District of California on July 30th, 2018, that was saying that the government could not give psychotropic drugs to kids without their parents' consent or a court order. We're talking about kids that have suffered extreme trauma and maybe they do need some psychological help, but the federal government was basically giving kids these psychotropic meds so that they'd behave and so they'd be calm and listless. And so the group of lawyers that I'm a part of filed this class action litigation. We got this court's order, and still, even now, I mean, this is March, there's still ongoing litigation in this case about this issue.
You write a lot about the power of lawsuits, especially right now when you're talking about this particular case. Is there any way in the future, do you think that administration officials will be held accountable for these horrific policies, especially when we learn more about how these children are being affected by, you know, even holding them, separating from their families? That's horrific. But then when you add the drugs and the abuse, that takes it to another level. Will there be any accountability in the years to come? And what would that look like?
I don't know. I mean, we're talking about a country that the Bush administration perpetrated some horrible war crimes and against U.S. citizens, right, holding them in detention. There's been no repercussions for any of that behavior at all. I've heard some chatter about policies that would be sort of like a victims fund, similar to what happened after 9/11. So maybe have some sort of fund to pay out to the victims of family separation or things like that. I don't know if that would be any help to these families at this point. But no, I don't see any hope for holding people accountable. I mean, I think Donald Trump knows he's above the law, and I think we've seen people throughout his administration are being held accountable in some ways, but I don't think anything of this nature will be brought to the fore later.
J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda is an immigration lawyer working at the Immigration Law Clinic at the UC Davis School of Law. He's a former Immigrant Justice Corps Fellow and Fulbright Scholar. He's out with his first book, No Human is Illegal, An Attorney on the Front Lines of the Immigration War. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about where we're at right now, questions about children, about people coming to the United States, what they face at the border, we'll also talk about that in a few minutes. And if you have a personal story to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. The guest said two things which I'd like to draw attention. The first was he outlined, which I completely agree with, the detrimental effects of the U.S. support of various dictatorial regimes and oligarchical regimes in Central America. And then that contributes to people having miserable lives and then leaving and wanting to come to the United States. Then he said that we should do things to help those nations. My perspective is that when money is given, quite the United States knows that it's going to the dictators themselves and to the oligarchs, not to the people. So maybe I would like to know how he feels about maybe we should, the goal should be just to leave things alone there. And if we stop making things worse, then things will get better by themselves.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, William. And if I said that, I misspoke. I think that the U.S., when they dole out foreign aid, it always comes with strings attached. And I think that the U.S. has its own interests at heart more than any other thing. And so to think that we can help those nations, it's always a slippery slope, because help is always helping the U.S. first. I mean, we're in a president that has America first, right? So anything that we do in those nations is could be really detrimental to those countries as well. I don't know if the idea is to leave them alone, if that's the right thing either. But at the very least, we don't need to severely traumatize the people that we're sending back to those countries, because I think that is only making things worse. And that was my point.
Well, thank you, William, for calling in. Let's go next to Cynthia in San Francisco. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello, Rose, and many thanks to your guest. I am very impressed and overwhelmed by the work that you do, and I just would like to say that you commented that there is little hope for litigation correcting these horrendous wrongs, and I can't help but agree with you. However, at the same time, I want to say that it's people like you that hold up hope for all of us, that in some way, somehow, in other avenues, this may be addressed and corrected in the future. And I think what you were doing is really remarkable and such a uphill, difficult struggle. I would also like to say, just share a very quick story. I'm an American citizen. I am married to a man from India who holds an Indian green card. It's permanent. He was able to obtain it by coming to this country when such things were still possible. And he could very easily have become an American citizen when he was married to me. However, he's very, very proud of his heritage. His ancestors were with Gandhi very closely, and you know, it's a strong tie, and many immigrants have strong ties to their homeland, not surprisingly. But my story is this, that when the first wave of children came to the United States without families through Central America and got to the Texas border and were met with jeers, and, you know, I think they were the first group en masse of children that were incarcerated. My husband received a call, and they said in this call that it was ICE calling, and that he was about to be, he should look out his driveway because there was probably a sheriff's car waiting for him to take him away, that he was in violation of several serious federal crimes regarding his immigration status. They did not state what it was. And they said he would be extradited to a foreign country immediately because he broke many federal laws. And they gave a number for him to call, which he did. It turned out to be the correct number, and we could never get through. But you can imagine what this did to our lives. Well, finally, we tracked down a very, very good immigration lawyer, such as yourself, and it turned out that my husband was one of the first of hundreds of people in this country who received similar calls, and they were all erroneous. They were all threatening just to create fear and, you know, worse than fear. I thought I'd never see my husband again. The beginning of the crescendo of hatred and things that we see now, but they traced it to, they had all his information. They had his name, they had his, you know, his immigration card, the date he came, the date he was supposed to, you know, that it wasn't an expiring card, all this confidential information on him. So they think it was somebody from the federal government who was making calls such as this in, you know, a horrible way. So, the beginning of a story that we are living through at much heightened, horrible levels now, but just wanted to share that.
Yeah,
and nothing ever
sharing.
Happened after that, Cynthia?
Excuse me?
Nothing ever happened after that? You didn't get
no.
another call? Or
okay. Well, we tried wow. to call and call and call, and we did reach right. the federal government number, could never get through, and the lawyer who we talked to got back to me, and she said, just wait it out. Don't do anything.
Wow.
Doesn't sound right. They would not extradite you in this fashion. I don't think it sounds right at all. Don't do anything. Sit on your hands, which we did for months, dying, you know, not being able to sleep at night and all the rest of it. And finally,
wow.
she said, you know, she's a San Francisco lawyer. She's great. And she said, your husband was the first person, you and your husband are the first person that called me. Since that time, I have gotten hundreds of calls.
Wow. It just sounds so frightening, Cynthia. Thank you for sharing that. JJ, have you heard about this? Anything like this?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that go on that we don't hear about that aren't reported, and especially with ICE now under this administration, they sort of have a free rein to do a lot of these things. And I, for example, when I used to work in New York City, there were people that would go around and flash a fake badge and say they were ICE agents and ask immigrants and tell them that they were going to get picked up and deported if they didn't give them immediately like $200 or something like that. And the immigrant, of course, would hand over the money so they wouldn't get picked up by ICE, and then the guy would go on his way. And they weren't ICE agents at all. But I think there's two things happening. There's ICE having more of a free rein than they've ever had before, and there's people that are preying on families like Cynthia's who live in fear.
Mm. Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that, Cynthia. I'm glad nothing happened. JJ, I want to talk about Maria Rogelia's story. You were working an enormous caseload as a volunteer and had very little time to prepare for hearings that would decide your client's fates. Your first client there was Maria. She was deported, shipped, quote-unquote, as the U.S. government refers to it, and dropped off without any kind of resources or money in Nuevo Laredo in northern Mexico, where she didn't know anyone and she had no way of getting back to her home, which was nearly 2,000 miles away. Again, it's so important to talk about the stories about what happens after people are deported. Can you tell us more about Maria's case?
Well, I wish I knew more about the people that are deported, because, you know, and as much as we'd like to think we win all the cases, it's not true, and especially during this administration, you put in longer hours and you don't seem to have as great a result. So there are people who are being deported, and unfortunately we really don't know what happens to them when they are deported. I shared Maria Rogelia's story because the security guards told me that she was shipped, just put on a bus and went over to Mexico. It's like, I mean, if Canada were to deport a Texan, you'd just drop him off in Mexico, in Michigan, right? And with no way to get home. So it's a really difficult situation, and it happens a lot with Mexicans, because Mexican youth that come to the U.S., through the, I think it's the TVPRA from 2008, they can be removed right away. They don't have to go into a detention center or apply for anything in the U.S., so they're treated differently than other people from Central America. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, but for me, Rogelia's case, yeah, it was one of those quick decisions by a judge, and before you had time to file anything, because she's from Mexico, she was already deported.
You write that shipped is the actual term the government uses, as if people were packages and ICE were employees of FedEx just doing their jobs. They use that word shipped?
They did back then, yeah. I don't know what word they're using now, but I doubt it's really positive either.
And I mean, how common is it for the government to do what they did to Maria? Drop someone off, send them back to a place where they know no one, and they have no way of getting to their actual home. Do we know how often this happens?
I don't know, actually, no. But, mm-hmm. I mean, for people that are deported back to Central America, Central American countries like Guatemala, Honduras, or El Salvador, they're put on a plane, and there's not a lot of airports in those countries. And so the U.S. government will fly them to an airport and drop them off there, make sure they get off the plane, and then they'll make their way from there.
Yeah, there was a very surreal piece in The New Yorker about how multinational corporations are actually meeting immigrants deported to El Salvador on the tarmac and asking them to work at their call centers.
No, I didn't hear about that. That's
yeah, it's just some very surreal when I read about that. We've got just a couple minutes left, and I want to read an email from Kaveh in Oakland. He says, thank you for your work, JJ. I love the title of your book. I'm an Iranian-American that would not be in the United States if it were not for the 1953 CIA coup and the subsequent chain of events in my birth country. It's hard not to despair a bit to see what's going on with the xenophobia and the racism that has sprung up again, and I would add, so openly in this country and under this administration. It's hard to know what to do. What are some of the most effective avenues to mobilize against this, apart from writing one's representative, in terms of volunteer time, protests, monetary contributions? And before you answer that, we've got a related question from Susan in San Francisco. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, it was basically the similar question is, like, other than get rid of this administration and all the Republicans that are enabling it, is there something that we can do right now, an organization that we can send money to, a specific letter writing campaign that we can participate in, like, for people who want to take action right now after listening to this show?
And to add to that, Doris also said, thank you for your work. Is there a way that we can sponsor a migrant? What are your thoughts, JJ? How can people get involved?
Yeah, I've been getting these questions a lot, and they're so heartening to hear. And I think all of the above, everything that was mentioned in the email, monetary contributions, calling your representative, voting everyone out of office that is perpetrating these harms, sort of all of the above. I think there's incredible organizations like Al Otro Lado, Esperanza, even us at the Immigration Law Clinic, and Legal Services for Children. There's incredible organizations, Centro Legal de la Raza, especially in this area, that are doing California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation, all these great organizations that are doing incredible work defending immigrants from deportation or from the horrible conditions of confinement. And in terms of sponsoring youth, it can be complicated. There's sort of levels to sponsorship, and it starts with parents, aunts and uncles, brothers, sisters, goes down to friends. Most of the time, they have to have some relation with the person sponsoring them. But a lot of the youth do go into foster care. So if there's people that want to enter into the foster care system and apply through that way and to receive youth, then I think that would be great, because there's always a need for that, whether it's for immigrant kids or non-immigrant kids. And then the monetary contributions as well. These, like I mentioned earlier about the flights, a lot of the detention centers actually have really horrible food as well. So there's a couple like anonymous donors that send me money from time to time, so we can send pizza and tacos into the detention facility for the kids to eat and have a little bit better food. So we have an agreement with the detention center that they'll let us do that. So a lot of these things are really wonderful, just improving the conditions for these people.
J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda is an immigration lawyer working at the Immigration Law Clinic at the UC Davis School of Law. His new book is No Human is Illegal, An Attorney on the Front Lines of the Immigration War. And if you are in the Bay Area, J.J. will be speaking Thursday, March 21st at East Bay Booksellers at 7 p.m. That's 5433 College Avenue in Oakland. J.J., thank you for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ruth.
Thank you so much. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with policy analyst Jihad Abu Salim and Ahmad Ambu Artima, one of the organizers of the Gaza Great March of Return. That was a mass protest that called for the right of return for Palestinian refugees and an end to the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip by Israel. A UN report found that Israeli forces killed 183 Palestinians, 35 children, and shot 6,000. What has been the impacts of Israel's decade-long blockade on Gaza? That is tomorrow. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. You can find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar.